morning. Sorry we're late. We're trying to see if kindergarten has legs to have a full day kindergarten. So that's just trying to ascertain that issue. So today we are going to return. We're going to do Senate Bill 427, which is the school funding formula. We'll do that bill, and then we'll do 2046, which I know a lot of you are here for, which is the earned income tax credit, which is an important issue, and we'll do that immediately following changes to our school funding formula. Thank you for your patience. So with that, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 427, and Steve, I think we're looking at three or four different issues in this bill.
Mr. Chair, you have, from the last meeting on Senate Bill 427, the discussion centered around the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments. Both of those had the high cost disability grant being continued with a $25,000 floor per student with a $17 million total cost per year limit. The difference between the three and fours is whether there was a small high school grant of $2.5 million a year for two additional years, or the next biennium. Then you also have, for new amendments, the Dash 6 and the Dash 7. Both of those have a high-cost disability in at the $25,000 floor level and $17 million cap. Both have, what's new to the 6 and 7 is there's a facility grant increase from $17.5 million per biennium to $25 million per biennium beginning in 07.
And which one is that?
That's in both the 6 and the 7s.
Okay.
So it would start in the 07-09 biennium, not the 05-07, so it would be delayed 2 years. And then the difference between the Dash 6 and the Dash 7s is the Dash 6 has the No Small High School grant, supplemental grant. The Dash 7 has the small high school supplemental grant being extended for two additional years at the $2.5 million level per year as it is now. So those, and then the Dash 8 deals with all-day kindergarten. The Dash 8 isn't a standalone amendment. It assumes that one of the 3, 4, 6, or 7 amendments will be adopted, and then the Dash 8 would be with that, because the Dash 8 does not delete the content of the original bill, the transportation language. And then we had two additional amendments brought in this morning, the Dash 9 and the Dash 10. The Dash 9 deals with a percent, 65% of the monies from the state school fund and local revenue, essentially formula revenue, they have to be spent on classroom instruction. And classroom instruction includes teacher salaries, benefits, instructional assistant salaries and benefits, librarians, salaries and benefits, teacher instructional assistant, librarian staff development, and textbooks and supplies in the classroom. And that would begin in the 06-07 year, so it would be delayed 1 year.
Whose amendment is that?
My son's.
Senator Stars. Okay. We'll have him. Senator Bruce Stars. We'll have him talk about that. Okay.
And then the Dash 10, I believe, was brought in by Senator George this morning. And I'm not real familiar with this, but it requires at least 51% of the projected personal income tax revenues be appropriated to the state school fund. And the other language, I'll have to ask Senator George or Paul to address, because they're much more familiar with that than I am.
Okay, Senator George, you have the Dash 10s.
We have the Dash 10s. And Paul recognized it right off the bat this morning as something that he's worked and helped to draft. And basically, if I could kind of give a description,
please.
As we've seen year after year, K through 12 kind of be held hostage to the end. What this attempts to do is to say, look, right off the bat, we're going to take 50% of the personal income tax and dedicate it, to K through 12. And it also has an adjusting factor that if the tax receipts grow above the 8%, I think you have a copy of the talking points on it, that in fact there would be half of the additional revenue would go to the new successful school fund, and then the other half would go to the education stability fund.
So similar to the speaker's plan.
It is the speaker's plan.
It is the speaker's plan.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to have some fun here today. I didn't know we had these amendments, but that'll make life a little more interesting for us. So now, Steve, if we wanted to do the small high school, the facility grant, and the disability, that's the dash six.
Dash seven.
Dash seven. It's that. Okay. So on facility grants, Gary, are you here?
No.
There you are, in your usual seat. Do you want to come talk to us about the facility grant? And school mafia, if y'all want to, we're considering different things, so you're way in the back, but if you want to talk on some of these, just wave your hands. We're in work session, okay? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gary Conkling, and I'm representing the Beaverton School District. The Dash 7 amendment, as Mr. Meyer noted, includes three items. The change that I'll focus on is the facility grant change. This provision was put into the formula several years ago to respond to the limitations on bonds that schools can have when they build a new school. There are certain costs that you can't bond. Those are costs that when you do have a new school facility have to be absorbed because they involve chairs and other essential parts of operating a school. So the net effect is that they really are a cost that you have to absorb in your operating revenues. So what the facility factor was an attempt to do in concert with the, I think, philosophy that factors in the formula should reflect externalities, costs that are really beyond the control of a particular district. And certainly this limitation and those costs fall into that category, is to help compensate districts when that school facility is actually put into use, the year that it's put into use, to help them really pay for some of those costs. As it turns out, the this facility factor, when it was introduced, had a cap of $17 million, which at the time was what the Oregon Department of Education thought was all of the eligible construction costs that had been flagged for it. It turned out that that wasn't the case. There were substantial numbers of others. And to the best of my knowledge, and I think Steve perhaps maybe has actual data, the formula which was, or the factor which was designed to cover 8% of costs has never really reached that number. It's always been prorated down and substantially down. I think actually typically less than half, around half anyway. So what the amendment in Dash 7 does is prospectively change that cap from $17 million to $25 million. It does not make the change until the 2007-2009 biennium. So it has no impact on the formula in the current, or excuse me, in the coming biennium for which you are having a discussion and debate in this building about the level of school funding. So it is not a shifting funds around change. What it does do by putting it into the formula now is it allows the governor, the committee that is doing forecasting for school needs, and ultimately the legislature itself, to deal with this as a fact in the 2007-2009 budget arena. And I think this is a good way of making sure that these costs, which are real costs, districts do have to build, in some cases rebuild or renovate and expand facilities, that they are helped cover costs that they have no other way of covering other than, absent this, in their own basically operating revenues. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Conkling? Yes, Senator.
Gary, the block on being able to actually put in the chairs, the computers and everything else was blocked by the result of measure 47 and 50. Is that correct? Or being able to bond for those?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, my memory fails me. Which of the two it was, whether it was 5 or 4750?
47.
It was 47.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So let's take these one at a time. So the dash sevens, Senator Pozanski, I don't know if you were here for what is what in front of you.
Oh.
Dash sevens are the facility grant, the high cost disability, and the small high school. And we'll just do them one at a time. The dash eights are the full day kindergarten. The dash nines are Senator Starr's amendments, and the dash tens are Senator George / the speaker's plan for 50% of revenue would go to, income tax would go to K through 12. So who would like to speak on the dash sevens? This is an issue we've heard more about. Facility grant, high cost disability, and small high school. Anyone on the dash sevens? You don't have to. Okay, so the dash sevens, I'm ready to adopt the dash sevens if the committee's ready to adopt the dash sevens, then we'll move on to the eights.
I'm chair.
That's twice
I've done that. I guess I serve on two committees where the chair is the madam. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash seven amendments to Senate Bill 427.
Senator Sires moved the dash seven amendments to Senate Bill 427. Discussion. Any objections to that motion? So ordered. Okay. Dash 8's Representative Mark Hass. This is the full-day kindergarten, and Steve, do you want to talk about this issue?
The Dash 8 would allow school districts that have full-day kindergartens to have essentially a weight of 1 for those full-day kindergarten students, and the districts that just have half-day or all half-day classes would still be at a half-day weight. So it would affect... Currently we have some idea of the number of districts that have full-day kindergartens, but it essentially would open it up to all districts, and those districts that adopted the full-day kindergarten then would have a full weight for each of those kindergarten students. Currently there's about 4,000 students having full-day kindergarten, so the additional weight for those would be about 2,000.
Representative Hass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, fellow revenue colleagues. This is a simple formula change from 0.5 to 1.0 for full-day kindergarten. This bill was heard more fully by the Education Committee, and I've handed out a little fact sheet on this. The research on the benefits of full-day kindergarten compared to what we do now, 2.5 hours, I think is irrefutable. I'm Mark Hass from House District 27. And
would you pull the mic a little closer to you?
Is that what you were trying to get me to say? Okay. The research on the benefits of full-day kindergarten is irrefutable. I don't think anybody in this room would question that, particularly the sort of the threshold mark in education, which is reading proficiently by third grade. And there are some pretty reliable statistics and pretty deep research on what happens if you can't read proficiently by third grade. And 75% of those kids end up dropping out. And educators say that full-day kindergarten is a key factor in reading skills, social skills, and math skills. So it's undeniably a beneficial thing. And a lot of people forget when we talk about full-day kindergarten that it's not like we're not doing kindergarten now. In fact, it's the most expensive grade we fund on a time basis. It's not like we're not spending upwards of $250 million biennium for 2.5 hours a day. By adding another 2.5 hours, you don't have to repeat a lot of those costs. Heat is already there. And so, as you can see in your sheet that I handed out, the actual increase in dollars is something below 30%. In other words, it's not twice as much. So for that, I think you get a good bang for your buck. I think it's the best value we could buy in terms of trying to give some increasing quality to our educational system. I know the what you referred to, Mr. Chair, as the education mafia is ambivalent or opposes this. And I understand that. While it's not mandatory for school districts to do, it will have the effect of watering down the formula. I understand that, just like anything else does, though, just like computers. I think a lot of Oregon citizens would be surprised to know that we actually have to pass a law to put something that's basic into the K-12 program. We didn't have to pass a law over the last 20 years to start adding computers into our school system, but you have computers in every classroom in Oregon now. Well, this is a pretty basic, fundamental part of K-12 education. 33 states have full-day kindergarten now. And ideally, the original bill had a component to reorganize ESDs to make room for upgrading kindergarten to full-day. And I don't know what the fate of that is, but I think there will be some savings from there. In addition, I think there are somewhere, depending on what the final figure will be for this year, somewhere around $500 million more for K-12 education than there was in this last biennium. Is that enough for K-12s? I'd be the first one to say no, it's not. But I would also say that there's an old saying, you can marshal an army to preserve the status quo. The easier thing here would be to listen to the people who don't want to change and don't want to improve and say we can't do this. That would be the easy road to go, I give you that. This is something that Oregon needs to do. I have a daughter in kindergarten, and when they added an hour-long reading program to that kindergarten program, every single parent signed up for that. The parents that have kids in public schools are hungry for this. And so I just encourage you to adopt this amendment. Let us work it through the House, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you. And thank you for your work. This has become somewhat of a passion for you, and it's a pretty convincing case, at least to myself. Questions for Representative Hass? Senator Dorff.
Representative Hass, years ago, before kindergarten, you know, now we refer to the system as K through 12. Okay, so it's the starting point. Mm-hmm. There was not a kindergarten program, so my wife and some other moms decided they were going to form a program actually outside of the school district, and they did. The amazing thing about that, and reading your second page was, is that what you indicated here was the case. We kind of tracked those kids from there on through the system. Absolutely excellent readers, because they initiated a reading program right off the bat for those kids. And I think we just don't take seriously enough how much of an impact there is with K-12. But I really appreciate what you've hit here, because it is a point in which those little brains are like sponges, and they just absorb so much good data if we give it to them, and it's it affects their education career from then on. So I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you.
That wasn't the question. I'm sorry again.
Yeah, well, no, I agree with you. Senator Bozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably more of a comment, but also a question for Representative Haas. Regarding this proposal, knowing that it would, in fact, dilute the funding formula for this cycle, because this would go in effect for this next one, would you be willing to entertain maybe doing something like on the high facilities grants, where that's not going into effect until the 07-09 budget, and that way schools would actually be able, districts would be able to prepare and for the future as to what this may mean for them to be able to provide that type of a service, and also give us as a legislature the opportunity to actually take that into consideration as to maybe increasing the amount of funding that we're currently seeing going into the K-12 process, knowing that we have to some level locked out any changes as to knowing what the size of the pie is for this cycle.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bozanski, yes, I would. I am anxious, though, about getting this in this bill today, and the amendment says 205-206, so unless we could conceptually amend that to 1 year later. But the answer is yes. think that's reasonable compromise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly believe that this is the most important learning age for all of our children. My concern and regret in this amendment is that we're not mandating. And so my concern is that we dilute the school formula to reach those parents who are most concerned about their children having full-day kindergarten. And we're not going to reach those most needful of full-day kindergarten. I guess that's the trouble I face. And how would you respond?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, it's an excellent point. The original bill called for that. And it was criticized for being heavy-handed and a mandate, and that we should give options to school districts who might not want to go, at least not this first year. My sense is, though, that this is the first step toward that. It may take a year or two, but this is a way to go that direction. I totally agree. It should be mandatory, but this at least gives some flexibility to school districts for whatever reason who don't feel the need to do it. And so it was a move to make it more flexible and to be, I guess, less heavy-handed.
Thank you.
Other questions or thoughts? Or works in the past? Noringo, you want to get in on...
He's
doing well. Okay, so here comes Chuck. Chuck and Lori... Anyone else want to testify on the Dash 8s?
Good morning. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, what an exciting morning. You've taken a bill that preserved... we thought a couple of worthy existing programs, extended them into the future, the High Cost Disability Fund, as well as the Small School Fund, which we didn't change the funding on, and the bill has begun to grow, and you're taking on some really interesting educational policy issues, formula issues, and probably more importantly, funding issues. At a time that the Senate funding number is going down, the House number is not going up for K-12, and we're looking now at a movement from 12 to 17 million in the High Cost Disabilities Fund. Not our idea, yours. We would prefer to have had it stay at 12, increase the funding level or the requirement to in excess of $30,000. And the K-12 community, I think, felt we could handle the issue at that level and handle it appropriately. And inside the revenues you all are willing to provide us. We're not asking, certainly we understand the interests of those who are, increasing the facilities grant in 07-09, which is a good way to escape discussion in the budget committees on whether or not the change in facility grant to 17 to 25 is an appropriate one. But it certainly doesn't escape notice that you're changing the formula in these two bills, that you're beginning to move funding around in substantial numbers. And when you add all-day kindergarten, or add this kindergarten bill, which there's no debate on the value of kindergarten, and that's not what we're arguing. But again, you're diluting the amount of money available to the kids that are in school now. And I think it's being done on the quick, without full discussion, without a run to see who wins, who loses, how this money is being redistributed. All in all, it seems you've taken a good bill in Senate Bill 427 and then taken a batch of really interesting ideas that we thought would be discussed during the interim, during a review of the formula, and tried to cram them into this bill. And I just would ask you to go back to 427, kind of, it's all real exciting, but catch your breath and go back to the original bill and move this along. These are needed programs. These are programs we know work. We know how the funding moves. And I hope you'll take another look at your decisions this morning on this. We're just real concerned, particularly without any runs in place, to know what's going on here. Thank you.
Senator George.
Chuck, K through 12 budget. Last coming out of this, the budget we're in right now is $4.9 billion,
yeah.
$4,900 million. The governor came out with $5,000
million. Yeah,
right now, I would imagine that we, when you put the whole thing together, we're probably $5,350, somewhere in there. Okay, so if you think about that, now we're talking $400 million more than where we are right now in this budget. So I think there is a chance to look at how the dollars are going to... They're all going to go to a school. You know, and if it was the Dash 9s, all it says is get it out there for instruction. And the other one says we're going to put these dollars up here front. First shot at the tax is going to be a K-12. So I think that these things fit very well with the idea that we are stepping up. I mean, most of my districts couldn't believe that we got over, 5.2. And so help me with that. Why do you think that... I see you nodding. You agree with the numbers.
I agree with what you're saying, Mr. Chairman. Those are not the amendments I was addressing the amendments I've been looking at this point. Certainly be glad to go on to the other amendments as they're discussed, and we'll come forward on those if you'd like us to. We've been very interested in the speaker's plan and be glad to discuss in detail where these numbers come from in the Dash 10s. I frankly haven't had a chance to really think about the 65% allocation number. I apologize for that. I just haven't got any thoughts. I'd leave that to my colleagues. I really am talking, I feel, I hope you understand about the changes that I specified.
Dash 8.
Well, the Dash 7, Dash 8. Are the ones Dash 6, Dash 7, Dash 8, all that package, I guess, and what I think the impact is there. So, but I certainly, you're going to each get to go home and politically defend what you've done here. And far be it for me to argue with you giving us increased funding. But we will argue whether or not it's adequate increased funding. And we would, I think, consistently argue it's inadequate. And when you start adding programs like kindergarten and diluting the funding available to the kids we're dealing with now by this change in the way the configuration of our student bodies look, we're going to argue we don't have enough funding to deal with these kinds of programs.
Can I do a
follow-up?
Chuck, you agree that you think an enhanced kindergarten is a good idea in a full day. And I always look at things like, okay, if I make an investment early and I'm able to get these kids so when they hit third grade, as Representative Haas said, that I know they're going to be successful through. I actually reduce the cost further on out there because I'm not having to remediate things that the kids learned early. And so when I put this equation together, I think, well, actually we may end up saving money. In other words, maybe more money because we're not having to deal with kids that never did learn to read when they got to the third grade.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I certainly am not going to argue with you that successful students start early. Successful students start reading out their mother's knee like probably all of us did. And if folks are at home and have the time and they can add to the experience, if we can add all-day kindergarten, if we can add a whole variety of opportunities that all of us have probably enjoyed over our lifetimes, they're going to be better students. And there's no argument. We make the argument regularly, if you would invest more in public education, you could spend less in corrections and on other human services programs. So I know the argument, but the bottom line, I think, term is investment. And you all have to determine whether or not you're making the investment in K-12. And while you can move these deck chairs around all you want, they're still deck chairs and the boat's still sinking. And we're real concerned about it. And when you see a bill like this and you see this thing happen this morning that we see happening, it kind of it sort of brings it up in your throat a little bit that maybe it isn't understood just how difficult things are going to be at these budget levels. And to add additional programs, to move this money around, there are kids in classrooms that will lose as a result of decisions that could, if they grew from this bill into and reached the governor's desk, would be potentially negative for kids in some districts or in all districts. We don't know because we don't have runs. We don't know what this means exactly. And it would be helpful to have that, I think, too, as we discuss these issues.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, you know, a couple of things I think are important. When on your testimony regarding the kindergarten concept that Representative Hass has in the Dash 8s today, you made the comment that you were concerned about this, that this was, you know, coming in on the quick, I think was the word that you used. And I think for the record, you know, need to get back on that. That's not the case. You know, we've had hearings on this issue in this committee. They've had hearings on it in education. This is not anything new, and this is not something that we have not had a discussion on. So I think that's the first thing. This is not a new concept someone walked into the room with. I've seen those in the past, but this is not one of those. The second thing is that I think is really important is that, and I think it gets back to the issue of all the different things that we're talking about when we talk about the school formula, and I think he really hit on it when you talk about, well, we haven't had a chance to look at the runs. And I think part of the problem, and I think what the legislature continues to deal with and wrestle with, is that the legislature is to set the policy for education. And yet we hear so much, well, forget the policy, what does the run look like? And everybody wants to look at schools and their runs and who wins and who loses, as opposed to, well, how are we investing this in the appropriate parts of K through 12? And, you know, the run really is secondary. It should be secondary to whether this is the right policy. I mean, you mentioned that this could have potentially negative impacts. Well, it could have potentially positive impacts. The question is for the legislature is to determine if an additional investment in kindergarten might make better education opportunities for grades 1 through 12. And then that would be a positive impact. If, in fact, the revenues that were being invested in grades 1 through 12 reached a more receptive student because of moving some of those dollars more in the kindergarten. And a lot of statistics have shown you have better students, and if they don't get off to a good start, yeah, you need more tutors, you need more individual education programs. That takes money, that takes dollars, that takes more staff, and maybe you wouldn't have as much if we invested earlier in kindergarten. But that really is a policy question, and the runs would be secondary to that. And then the final thing in looking at this issue, we do have a number of dashes, as you pointed out, before us today, but I think it's very interesting when you talk about taking a good bill, and the good bill you were talking about is the amendments to what actually is 427. When we're not talking about 427. 427 originally was my bill to turn the transportation reimbursement into a block grant, and I thought it's very interesting that we're not talking about that bill anymore, Mr. Chair, because the Chalkboard Project yesterday came out and endorsed that concept of the block grant and believed it could save up to $30 million, which, by the way, would fund pretty much this this kindergarten program. So I think everybody is struggling with trying to do the right thing for our kids with the resources we have available. But we have to move beyond this, well, you know, it's the runs, it's this or it's that. We have to look, what is the policy with the dollars that we can maximize the investments in our kids so that the rest of the system, that they get the maximum benefit and that we don't have to spend dollars chasing mistakes that we made earlier in their careers. And I applaud Representative Hass for this. I don't know. Is it the perfect solution? You know, I don't know. But I really think that the data has clearly shown, and Senator Starr has been a real expert and advocate on brain development for child, 0 to 2 years old. We know that the earlier the investments that we make, the better children react to all kinds of things down the road. But those are policy decisions, and I don't think this is a thing that's on the quick. We will have to give it due consideration, but I think it's an important part of it, and I think we need to remember that we're all partners trying to come up with the right solutions here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, certainly I Your points are debatable. If you can, and I can hear what you're saying in terms of there are lots of great ideas, great policy initiatives that could be brought to this legislature. The bottom line here is the money. And you can dismiss the runs, I guess, and maybe we do refer to them too often. I mean, I won't argue with you on that sometimes we defer to them. The reason we do is when you start moving this money around, you're talking about kids' programs. You're talking about whether or not they're going to have music, or they're going to have art, or they're going to have a school newspaper, or they're going to have athletics, or they're going to have PE. The runs, the money. It is the policy driver at the local level. That's really what's right now. Local school boards out there are making budget decisions, which are policy decisions, perhaps not as grand as those made here, but they're policy decisions that are affecting these kids' lives as they decide what they will and won't have in a classroom. So when you move $20 out of a school district per child, or $10 or $5, the result is a change in that child's program. And whether or not they have kindergarten or not, or all the rest of that, certainly we can debate it here. And I don't think there is probably a debate on the effects of kindergarten on a child's education and their future. I think Representative Haas makes a great case. I think we'd all love to see it. And at $5.8, $5.9, $6 billion, we can start talking about seriously doing all these great ideas. But I really ask you not to just not to just dismiss the arguments of the runs. I think it really is the policy driver at the local level. It really does have to do with these kids' education and what the outcome looks like. On the quick, I guess, is just when you walk into a room and see it, it feels quick. I apologize for...
It's June.
It still feels quick. And it may be that when you don't realize you're going to see a kindergarten bill and a bill, it just catches you that way. And I think there are still policy discussions that could go on about whether or not the weight of a full student for a kindergarten student is the appropriate level for funding for kindergarten. Will you see schools, because it is less expensive to educate a kindergartner with a full weight, how many relocatables will show up on school campuses, because it is worth having those kids come to school to achieve that funding level. There's a lot of discussion left to be made here, and unfortunately it runs to the dreary science rather than to the higher policy questions, but the economics are important here.
Lori.
Mr. Chair, for your record, from the Education Mafia, I am Dawn Lori Wimmer Whalen from the Oregon Education Association. With your indulgence, I'd like to comment on the rest of the DASH amendments before us, as beginning with the kindergarten one, if that's sure. All right, so you don't have us traipsing up a couple times.
You're going to do the eights, the nines, and
yes,
the
Mr.
Tens.
Chair. Yes.
Okay.
Let me start with the full-day kindergarten discussion. The Oregon Education Association did express its concern in the substantive policy committees, not on the Senate side, but behind the scenes with legislators, because we do have some concerns. I'd like to take a little bit different angle. One of those is the distribution formula and what it was designed to achieve and what it was designed to do. And subsequent to the passage of Measure 5, the equalization formula was developed to capture uncontrollable costs and distribute money in a fair way so that students could have roughly equal amounts of funding relative to those uncontrollable cost factors that drive the expenses for individual school districts. We believe that this would be, by adopting the DASH 8s, a change in policy with respect to what the distribution formula is. We believe that as long as we sustain it as something that captures uncontrollable cost factors, we are having a rational policy conversation about cost drivers that that make the cost of education different on a per student basis from district to district, or even in some cases school to school. This is about an optional policy, and in these times of shortfall, I think we kid ourselves to say we're adding investment to this program. And like my colleagues, we wouldn't dream of disputing the wisdom of having a full-day kindergarten, nor would we dream of disputing the wisdom of fully funding Oregon Pre-K and Head Start. Even more importantly, the research shows that that's also an essential investment, because somebody up here said 0 to 2 is the critical time. We don't have those kinds of resources in the state right now, as we're all aware. And to move the chairs around, the deck chairs around on the Titanic, as also was referred to, an apt metaphor, doesn't seem to us to really accomplish what we need, because the downside to doing that is not whether or not those five-year-olds have a better program. Obviously, they'll have a better program and a lifelong head start. The fact is that some other aspect of critical services will suffer as a result in the zero-sum game of what distribution formula politics is. I like to kid that the distribution formula in Oregon is our version of pork barreling, because when we can't raise the money to bake a bigger pie, what we do is fight over how we slice it so that we can bring home bigger dollars to specific districts. And that's why the runs become so much a part of the discussion, because the winners obviously are going to advocate for those changes to the distribution formula to give them bigger slices for their kids. And I don't think that's very statesmanlike, but that is the way humans operate in a declining resource environment. The Oregon Education Association has taken a position with respect to distribution formula changes that looks like this. Our first priority is to deliver revenues to students to at least hold the line after a history of 3 years and $800 million worth of cuts to K-12. We want to hold the line. Obviously, that's a $5.4 billion budget and a pipe dream. Our second priority is, if there were extra dollars in addition to 5.4, we would spend them on buying back the program cuts we've endured, our students have endured in the last 3 years, all of them valuable, all of them serving the critical needs of different students, because not every kid is a five-year-old. We have students up to age 18, 19, even 21 in the case of special ed, all of whom have needs that we would like to address as fully and offer as much of a program as possible and help them achieve their goals. They, you know, starting out a good investment in the beginning is absolutely critical, but so too is providing the remedial efforts for the kids who are in the system now. If you saw the Oregonian yesterday, you saw three very compelling letters from children. One of them was 9 years old and a TAG student, and who was begging the adults of the state to hear their cries, their pleas for their education system. It made me cry. These are kids who get it. And we would just ask that we begin with that same parameter. Fully, you know, hold the line after all these years of cuts, then go back and restore, and then as a third priority, add value, extend or add new programs that have been shown to be pedagogically sound. I don't think that the way we deploy dollars or have deployed dollars are in some way ill-advised. We have Senator Morse always talks about the schools in Lebanon who are in effect already getting rid of 12th grade. They've actually encouraged students to get a part-time job or take courses off campus or what have you, because they simply do not have the funds to operate 12 full years. So are we trading a full-day kindergarten program for a 12th grade year? That seems to me a rather giant leap, but those are the kinds of, in a struggling economy and in struggling budget times, those are the kinds of choices that get that are compelled upon districts if at this level there is a mandate in effect or even an encouragement that shifts money around in this way. We believe that it'll be a situation of the haves versus the have-nots. Those are tooled up to begin offering full-day kindergarten right away, for example, your intuition would tell you, even absent a run, those would be the school districts that would be ready to go right away. Whereas other districts, perhaps in rural areas of the state or places where the funding has been even tighter, property tax lower and so on, might have a harder time competing for those dollars, and that's what you in effect get when you do this through the formula. We would argue that if a full-day kindergarten program is the number one priority for education in the state of Oregon, it ought to be a separate bill outside the state school fund and separately funded over the top of the appropriation. And absent that, you're just diluting, as you know, the program that we have. So that would be why we have our concerns with that amendment. Secondly, the Dash 9s seems like something that would be relatively benign, given that we have significantly more than 65% of dollars going directly to the classroom now, and that's, of course, a matter of definition of terms. It is our understanding that this is boilerplate language that's been offered at the national level, and that legislators throughout every state have been asked to submit bills or amendments like this as the first step in a two-part process of getting Tabor-like spending caps on the ballot, with the argument being we've already taken care of schools, so you know what happens to K-12 in your state won't look like what happened to Colorado. I don't know that that's the awareness of the sponsors of this amendment, certainly, but just so that you know, that is part of a national movement, and we just don't see it as necessary. We certainly support the notion of local control, and that percentages by themselves are rather rigid. They're not very useful or flexible or meaningful. What schools need to do is respond, and this is true of all of these amendments, to the needs of their local community, to the needs of their students, and offer programs that are proven to provide the best possible education to students without regard to specific percentages. I would argue, for example, that the school counselor provides absolutely essential services to help students succeed, and that's not technically money in the classroom, but it's certainly important. And our members who are counselors or child development specialists at the elementary level believe that they offer services that are vital to the educational outcomes of individual kids who need those services. With respect to the Dash 10s, this is in effect, as I'm quickly looking over it, I've just seen them this morning, it looks to me to be in effect the so-called Minnis plan, which we have testified to and worked in a work group on the House Revenue Committee side to try to amend to our satisfaction. We were unsuccessful in making this bill work for us in terms of, again, providing flexibility rather than rigidity, and actually 51% of personal income tax revenues is less than K-12 gets now. So it would immortalize what we would consider to be a mediocre level of funding, and therefore we would have to oppose it. We also oppose removing from the equation corporate income tax revenues because we believe there's a strong nexus between public education and delivering an educated workforce and the corporations who benefit from that investment in Oregon, and to absolutely 86 any investment by the corporate side of the income tax revenues seems to us to be a dangerous precedent. We would not be able to support that as well. With that, I'd be happy to take the questions.
Thank you. For the earned income tax folks, we'll start right at 10:15. So we're going to do this for about 15 more minutes. I know y'all have a press conference you want to go to. So we will start right at 10:15. We'll finish up on the school finance formula and start with you guys. Senator George and then Senator Metzger.
Lori, it's a coincidence that we had Dash 9s brought into this room because I was here early, and so we were telling a story about a gentleman who came in from my old hometown from many, many years ago, and we were talking about yesterday about the schools and how wonderful the schools were. And the interesting thing is that if you go back and look at that school district today, it's completely different in many ways. In those days, we had every program you can imagine. We were talking about a band and an orchestra. We were talking about industrial arts and an ag program, and we had all of these things that we had available for us. Now, if you take that budget back then and you adjust it all the way up to today, and we've done that, and looked at that school district, why is it that all those programs don't exist today? Well, it's a great question. And the answer to that is they actually have more net real dollars now than they did back then, but the programs are gone. So what's happened? And the answer was it is not classroom oriented. The focus today is programs are gone, but we have education bureaucracies in that town. I mean, they've literally built the new buildings are places to put what I call education bureaucrats. Now we're talking about here with about the kindergarten extension. We're talking about here making sure that these dollars get to the classroom. We're trying to go back and establish programs that do in fact get the dollars to the kids. I mean, I wish I could get you guys to give me a promise that you weren't going to demand increased wages and benefits and all these sort of things that run the cost up, but you're not going to do that. And so what I'm saying here is when we're trying to address these policy questions about wouldn't it be great to make sure that those dollars got back into that classroom, because that's where the emphasis was. the totality, and I think I've told you this story before, of all of the management of that school district, including the nurse, was five people for 900-plus students. The emphasis was in the classroom. You didn't need to worry about counseling because we were all being successful and enjoying our class, our school experience. So I'm telling you, it is time that we go back and address issues that are relative to the policies that we've established that have ended up with a degradation of so much of what we used to have as far as programs, and at the same time run costs out of the roof.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I too would love to go back to the good old days, and I wish that that was the society with which we operate today. And I simply would disagree with your analysis of where the cost drivers are. We know that the number one cost driver for us is not only increased enrollment, but increased enrollment of very highest cost disability students and English language learners. So if you consider special education in a group, as being both the special education side and the language learning side, as an EcoNorthwest study with the COSO OSBA recently did, they took a pretty hard look at that, and I think the evidence is pretty clear that those are the number one cost drivers. And those are costs that, of course, are a matter of not only humanity but federal mandates. We have a number of those federal mandates, also not as well-funded as the original promise, needless to say, and those are the cost drivers that I think that really have changed the nature of schools. Furthermore, community and family dysfunction and what that means in terms of the students who come in through the door. These are not private schools. These are public schools. We take all comers. We have students living out of their cars. We have students who come from homes that are severely dysfunctional in one form or another, and those societal problems are reflected in the kids who walk through the door. Schools are simply in the communities they find themselves, and they need to deal with those things in order to get to the education. It's hard to teach a hungry kid, so you have to provide those services. Furthermore, we are one of eight states that require a master's degree for continuing education, a point I've made in this committee before. So with respect to how you balance your budget and whether or not you expect employees to work cheaper in order to be able to do that, I mean, that's a policy decision that's yours to make, certainly, but we believe that a fundamental business principle is that you get what you pay for.
Look, I know we're going to need to move along, but I just, if I could add a comment to this, and that is, if you go back and you look at the things we were being taught, we were taught good parenting skills. We were taught to, you know, to eat the four of the good food groups and to stay away from drugs and alcohol. And those things aren't there today. So, I mean, part of the societal problem is the fact that we've had a continued change within the education system. And our efforts to go back and address the fact that these kids are qualified, that they can move forward in K through 12, and the fact that dollars are back to the classroom, is a big policy issue, and as you're indicating, it's not a big heartburn issue because you think you're there already. But I think we need to continue to put that pressure backwards, demand the feds get the money here that they mandate programs, send the cash. But also this idea that we need to look at this thing from the standpoint that we are failing, but we failed the last generation because you just admitted we have so many problems with these families. So policy, I believe, is important for this legislature to look at.
Further questions, discussions?
I have one, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Metz.
Just one question. Laurie, you had mentioned on the Dash 10 that 51% was less than what they're getting now. You know what that calculation would be if this were in place for this next biennium, what that the school number would be under this?
Mr. Vice Chair, or Senator Metzger, off the top of my head, I don't, and maybe my colleagues will, but it would be significantly less, I think. I know that what we got for this biennium was about 55%, if that helps.
Thank you, Chair.
One quick Yes,
I represent on the runs, I couldn't agree more with Senator Metzger, but with respect to kindergarten, a run would be incalculable. We've gone through this, Mr. Myers and I, because you don't know who would do it or not, and I think it's counterintuitive a little bit. I disagree with the notion that the well-to-do districts would do that. It may be just the opposite in effect, because so-called poor districts would be receiving a full weight for kindergarten students. So it's an incalculable run to do.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to close this hearing. Oh, excuse me. We're closing the work session on Senate Bill 427. I think it requires further contemplation and discussion before we move a bill. And we're going to open a works a public hearing on House Bill 2046.
Both the motions?
Yes. Eckert.
Okay. Can we reopen it, or if we want to?
As long as it's within the same meeting.
Okay. Let's do earned income tax credit. And we'll return to this point later. Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2046. Lizbeth.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, with House Bill 2046A, this is the bill dealing with the earned income tax credit. So it is making changes in terms of phasing in an increase in the percent of the federal earned income tax credit for Oregon's earned income tax credit, and it changes Oregon's earned income tax credit to refundable tax credit. And it's specifying that the refundable tax credit will equal 5% of the federal earned income tax credit, which is what it is under current law, but it will become refundable in tax year 2007. And then the percentages go up there each year. In 2008, then it's 7.5%, and then 10% in 2009 and beyond. And so just so you have a revenue impact statement and you have the staff measure summary, but you also have a research report. And I think we gave this out during orientation, but just so everyone knows, we do have a little bit of background on the earned income tax credit. And that research report is both on the working family child care tax credit as well as the earned income tax credit. And those were both enacted in 1997. And just some of the highlights on that program, basically, Oregon's earned income tax credit is currently at 5%, and it is not refundable, but the federal earned income tax credit is refundable. And then in, we've seen some growth in this program and stuff, which, again, is based on the federal earned income tax credit. In 1997, there were like 153,844 taxpayers that claimed Oregon's earned income tax credit, and it's grown 10% over the next 7 years. By 2003, then it was up to 170,034 taxpayers. The average, though, earned income tax credit in Oregon is quite modest since it is only 5% of the federal. So on average, it was roughly $68 in 2002 versus the federal, which was $1,609. Then what we've seen is, on average, it's this earned income tax credit has been a reduction of about $10.3 million on the state general fund. And then what we see is that the main purpose of the earned income tax credit was to target low-income working Oregonians and then to eliminate the tax liability for those Oregonians. So what we saw in 2003 from the tax return data was that under our current 5% EIC, that eliminated the tax liability for 59,392, or 35% of the personal income tax returns. So that's a small portion, and that was one of the reasons why the advocates for this bill wanted that earned income tax credit percentage to be increased. So basically, under the current 5% EIC, you've got 110,642 families that are still paying, and in 2003 they paid $56.9 million in Oregon personal income taxes. So I've got in the research report, you know, background on the different states and what the policies are there, but I won't go through that today. And as far as the revenue impact, it's beginning in 2007-08, because again, this is a beginning just in tax year 2007. So you've got a revenue loss of $6 million initially. It goes up because you are increasing that percentage. So it goes up to $12.5 million in 2008-09, and then $18 million by 2009-10. And so for a biennium, it's roughly $36 million when it's fully phased in. And I do have the feedback effects again, so everyone's clear. That's been in the Oregon tax incident model. When we had this discussion on the House side, we were also hearing some other stimulus bills. And so I ran this EIC tax cut in conjunction with some others, and so I thought feedback effects here in addition to the static numbers.
Thank you. Bob Cassania, Philip Kennedy Wong, Patty Whitney Wise.
Can I have a question answer before we
go? Yes, please.
Thank you.
While they get set.
That had, on the House, this bill had 55 aye votes. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming then that they have built into their budget numbers the provision for this slight reduction in
revenue. Senator George, he doesn't have an effect in the 05-07 biennium budget. Okay. So it's beginning in the 07-09 biennium. So, but yes, it will be. It's on our various lists and stuff when we look at the different bills that have revenue impacts.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel, Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference, which is the public policy voice of Oregon's Catholic bishops in service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians and in pursuit of a common good for all. What you have before you today, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2046, A, engrossed, is the latest step in a journey that began in 1988 before the Oregon legislature to introduce the concept of the refundable earned income tax credit. We didn't take the first step until 9 years later in 1997 on a non-refundable basis with the passage of what we have now as the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit at 5% of the federal Earned Income Tax Credit. So now, 8 years later, completing this 17-year journey, you have before you the attempt to make it refundable. And every session since 1997, there has been a bill before the legislature asking the legislature for consideration of making the Earned Income Tax Credit refundable at the state level. The interesting thing, if there's a word that could describe the approach to the earned income tax credit, I believe the word is bipartisan. This year is the 30th anniversary of the federal earned income tax credit, and when you look at the administrations that have seen either the enactment or expansion of the earned income tax credit, bipartisan is the word. It started under Gerald Ford. It was increased under President Ronald Reagan, increased again under President George Bush, increased under President Clinton, and the final expansion occurred under President George W. Bush. The goal of the Earned Income Tax Credit is to help move people out of poverty. It's to supplement their incomes. And the interesting thing at the federal level is that in 1986, the U.S. Catholic bishops wrote a pastoral letter called Economic Justice for All. And in that, they made a recommendation that people below poverty should not have a tax obligation. And the bishops framed their pastoral letter asking three questions with respect to economic decision making. How does it impact the poor? What does it do to the poor? What does it do for the poor? And how do the poor participate in it? And what you have before you is a bill to help lift people out of poverty. In 1995, Oregon adopted welfare reform. And the goal of welfare reform was to move people from welfare and public assistance to work. But the next necessary step is to move people not only from welfare to work, but to move people out of poverty. And this bill will help you do that. The impact doesn't start until the 07-09 biennium. And I know that the chair has a particular interest in no tax credit beginning unless it is worthy enough to begin this biennium. And we suggest to the chair and to this committee that if you are so inclined, we believe this tax credit is worthy of that consideration. After we testified in the House on House Bill 2046, I received a communication from the Oregon Center on Public Policy. And they said if the legislature's goal is truly to eliminate a tax obligation for people below poverty, they should step it up in incremental levels as high as 12% to truly eliminate those below poverty from having a tax obligation. And if the chair is so inclined to move this bill with beginning this biennium coming up, 05-07, we would ask for your consideration to then look at a 12% increment in a further step that can be implemented incrementally.
Sorry to interrupt you. Have you worked the numbers out on what
Okay, but
I have asked staff, and they're working on it. I spoke to the legislative revenue staff. If I could direct your attention to the piece of testimony we handed in from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which has been handed to you, and if I could direct your attention to page 4, because there's a very interesting chart on page 4, which illustrates where Oregon sits with respect to the states that have adopted earned income tax credits. Oregon was one of the first states to adopt a state-level earned income tax credit. When we did it in 1997, there were only like 5 or 6 states that had a state-level earned income tax credit, and we did it on a non-refundable basis because of the revenue impact. But if you look at the list of states now that have adopted a state earned income tax credit, most of the states that have moved in that direction have refundable state credits. And if you look at the percentages, you look at Colorado, you look at the District of Columbia, 25%. You might want to look at Minnesota, varies with earnings, an average of 33%. If you look at Wisconsin, the range is from 4% to 43%. These are states that have realized that welfare reform combined with both the federal refundable earned income tax credit and a state refundable earned income tax credit can truly lift people out of poverty to accomplish that twin goal of welfare reform of moving people from assistance to work and then lifting them out of poverty. The earned income tax credit at the federal level is the number one program that has assisted people in moving out of poverty. And if there is one step this legislature can take to spur that momentum of moving people out of poverty in Oregon, we believe it is the adoption of House Bill 2046. So we would submit this to you and ask for your favorable consideration. This has been a long journey, 17 years. Dick Yates wrote the first report in 1988. We requested Representative Tom Butler through Representative Pat Farr and through Representative Diane Rosenbaum to request an additional staff report. So the staff report you have before you is the second staff report since 1988. And we thank the staff for the preparation of that report and for the bipartisan support that this bill achieved in the vote on the House floor, 55-3. This has been a truly amazing and a cooperative effort on a bipartisan basis, and we would urge this committee to move this bill along. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question.
Yes, please.
Bob, in 1997, I can remember working with Jeanette Hamby because we were so concerned about the very poorest of Oregon, us building our budget on their back, and the fact that, but wasn't one of the reasons that we felt it necessary to move is because we were one of the states that got at the income of the poor at the lowest level. And I see heads nodding that that is the reason that we did that.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, Oregon's income tax, which is a relatively flat income tax, impacts the poor at a very low threshold of income, and that is the nature of the problem in terms of our revenue structure. The refundable earned income tax credit can help address that. When in 1997 the legislature adopted the non-refundable earned income tax credit, they also adopted the working family child care credit on a refundable basis. This would be, with some parallelism, this would be the bookend to the activity that occurred in 1997, which would complete that effort.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, obviously I am not, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, but Anthony Granados with the Oregon Catholic Conference. Philip is tied up right now, so I'm going to submit a summation of his testimony on behalf of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. One of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon's top legislative objectives this session is to reduce the tax burden on Oregon's poorest residents. A recent report indicated over 600,000 Oregonians without health coverage. With Oregon's relative flat income tax, as Bob referred to, the tax burden on the working poor is high and regressive when combined with property tax as passed through in rent. Close to 200,000 Oregonians would benefit from the refundability of the earned income tax credit, as highlighted in House Bill 2046. We need to empower people with the financial ability to regain a degree of control over their lives. Every dollar from the refundability of the EITC will be put back into the economy immediately. Refundability is an important feature of the Earned Income Tax Credit. Without it, low-income taxpayers cannot take advantage of their federal credit. In 2004, the credit for families with one child was $130 and $215 for families with two children. House Bill 2046 is an important step to making Oregon's tax system more fair and just. Of the 16 states with a state earned income tax credit, 13 have a refundable earned income credit. Oregon is only one of three without refundability. We ask for your thoughtful consideration and goodwill and hope you pass House Bill 2046. Thank you.
Thank you. Patty?
Good morning. My name is Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. I thank you for holding this hearing, and we're very hopeful that you can move forward a provision this year. I just want to make a couple of points following up on the previous testimony. One is that our lowest income Oregonians actually pay a higher percent of their wages in taxes than our highest income Oregonians. It is unfair, and what this bill does is address that fairness issue. It would raise many of the families above the poverty level before they have to pay taxes. Almost all of that money would inevitably go to put food on the table and pay for other basic needs, helping stimulate the local economy and helping those families succeed. Many of them are families with young children, and they really need those extra dollars if their children are going to learn in school. I think the other thing that's really important here is that while Oregon has finally moved up from being number one in hunger in the country to number eight, we still have a long ways to go, and this refundable tax credit would put dollars into those very families who are experiencing food insecurity and help make sure that their children don't go hungry. We urge you to pass this measure this session. Thank you.
Thank you.
I also have testimony from Noreen Goplin. She also had to leave for the press conference, and I have submitted that to you.
Great.
Wow. Mr. Chair, one footnote for you and the committee members. In 1986, with federal income tax reform, that effort was chaired by then-Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon and signed into law by President Ronald Reagan. One of the key features of federal income tax reform in 1986 was to eliminate a tax obligation of those below poverty. And in conjunction with the Bishop's Pastoral Letter on Economic Justice for All, we believe that is the proper policy at the state level as well, and would ask the state of Oregon to follow in those footsteps.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Marcia Kelly, Tina Kotek, Ellen Lowe. And we have been excused from the floor. It usually takes them at least 15, 20 minutes to go until 10:50. So we have 20 minutes of time here. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Deckard and members of the committee. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm here today for the American Association of University Women, representing about 2,000-plus women in the state of Oregon with branches in 28 cities or counties, Wallowa to Ashland, Pendleton to Portland, Lakeview to Lake Oswego. We oftentimes are noted for our stances on education, but little known, we have lots of policies regarding tax fairness and raising low-income people out of poverty into areas where they can pursue education and better their families. We are fully in support of this bill because it will put bread on the table, clothes on the backs, and the ability, especially of rural Oregonians, to partake in transportation costs. Transportation costs are estimated at 55 cents a mile, and for many rural areas there is no public transportation. It's pretty much centered in urban areas with the exception of like Lincoln County and Tillamook County. And transportation costs are important as well. Unlike more affluent Oregonians who might spend tax refunds on travel, stocks and bonds, you know, redoing their pleasure boat. That's probably what we do. This bill would allow low-income people to put the money right back into the economy. Like I said, clothes, food, rent, books for the kids, maybe for school supplies. Because of that, I'm a little bit unclear, and I'm not an economist. My degree from across the street was in American Studies. I probably should have done math and economics, but I didn't. I'm a little bit unclear about the feedback that is on the revenue impact statement, because this money, I think, would go directly into the economy in Oregon, more disproportionately an effect on the rural economy, I would think. And so I'm not an OTIM expert, but I'd just like to stress that I don't think these people are going to be putting it into anything that's not directly related to buying power right in their own communities.
Yeah, and OTIM, that's OTIM's job, is to basically look at that very issue of on something like this, which I think we all agree is that low-income folks are going to, any savings they have, they're probably going to spend on.
And that's how come I was wondering about the feedback effect, because it seems to me that the feedback effect is really, really low. And so maybe at some point in time we need to look at some of the calculations. Not saying that they're wrong. I just would like to sort of understand the OTIM, and I haven't studied it.
I just think you've got to look at it in terms of every income group has buying power. They just buy different things. And so when you're creating a tax cut, then you're creating more buying power for every group. And that's really all you're doing with this, is you're targeting the low-income folks. There's a lot of people in that group, and then that's why you're seeing feedback effects, is because they're going to be purchasing things. Yes, they may be necessities. They may not be luxury goods, but they're still necessities, and they're still things that are going to be helping the, you know, Krogers of the state, and, you know, all of the necessities are still a part of the economy.
Oh, yeah, I know. I understand that. That's why I'm concerned that the feedback effect that's shown is lower than it might.
Oh, lower than it might be?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, and this feedback effect, too, it phases in over 5 years, so you don't see the total amount until you look at the final year there, and you don't even have 5 years here. So your feedback effect is phased in over 5 years. So you get 20% each year that's added in. That's what you're seeing on your revenue impact statement. So you don't even really see the total feedback effect there.
I understand the phase-in, and I understand that. I just don't understand this money is going directly back into the economy, how the feedback effect would be so low. And at some point, you know, we don't need to debate that today because we have other people who need to testify, but I just really want to stress people are not going to be going out of state on $68 on an average refund.
Yeah, and I think we universally, as a committee, I don't want to speak for everyone, really does agree that this money would go right back into the economy locally.
Yeah, and with probably a disproportionately effect on the rural economy versus the urban economy.
Sure. Senator Starr.
Countering that, the state would be spending less money, and so the feedback is not all it. Might be.
That's true. So let's keep moving. Tina and Representative Rosenbaum, do you please come on up? And I'm just going to keep moving ahead. No one's in opposition to this, so we want to just, anything new is appreciated, too. But you guys are all veterans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum from Hess District 42. Also serve as a legislative member of the Hunger Relief Task Force, and so I became involved in this issue during the interim and actually worked on interim revenue with current Representative Pat Farr. He and I got this introduced as an interim committee bill. I don't think I have probably much new to add to the excellent testimony you've already had, except to mention again that this passed overwhelmingly when it was on the floor of the House. I think it was a 55-3 vote, so there was very little opposition. I think it's very clear that Oregon does tax people at a very low level of income in this state, and this is a step we can take by making this a refundable tax credit that will help the people at the bottom of the income ladder who are actually working hard to try to escape poverty, put a little more money into paying their rent, their medical bills, putting food on the table. I think it's a great step that the 2005 session of the legislature could take to make things better for those hardworking folks, and I would just urge you to vote the bill out speedily, and hopefully we can get it back over to the House side and have it become law. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Diane.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Zanski.
Just a point of clarification. It sounds like we have no opposition to the bill. I was wondering if the chair was going to entertain a motion in, through a work session today.
I'm not. I'm going to work with it, as Mr. Cassandra said. On tax credits, the general principle I put out there is that we have a number of them in our committee right now.
Right.
Is that I'm interested in doing these and paying for them today. And so I like the earned income tax credit a great deal, but my interest lies in actually finding a number that we can buy today and pay for today rather than putting it in the future biennium. And so I think the proponents of this are working on how we might be able to accomplish that, but I don't think that would happen today.
No, my comment was that if we were ready to move it, I was going to suggest that maybe we should go to that stage, but it sounds like we're not, and so maybe we need to take a little bit more public testimony.
Let's hear especially some, I think Ellen and Tina have a little new data for us. Ms. Love.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And for the record, I'm Tina Kotak, Policy Director with Children First for Oregon. You might wonder why we're here, why we care about tax credits, but let's not forget this is about the children of working families in the state. This is an extremely important bill. You've heard from us over the years of why this would be important to improve the financial stability of families. I actually went through my old reports. 01 data book, expand and make it refundable. Next one. The next one said the same thing. And in this year, you just received our poverty brief saying that's one way you can help working families this session. So I don't think we have to debate whether this is a good idea. So I think I'd like to address Senator Deckard's concern about paying for this biennium. I totally commend the principles you put forward about not passing something that we're paying out in the next biennium. I totally get that. That's good public policy. If there's going to be an exception this session, it should be 2046. We have waited since 97 to do something about creating greater fairness in our tax structure. This would be an incredibly missed opportunity not to pass this session. To get out of the House with such unanimous votes, it's a really good thing for families and children. So I would just urge you, if there's going to be a bill, this is the exception to that principle. And we will work with you, if you want to do it this biennium, to find the money to do it. Working families have waited too long to have some tax relief in our income tax structure. And I know there was some discussion around, well, if we did this, we'd have to perhaps do some kind of reduction in capital gains. From our point of view, those are apples and oranges. The income, the fairness issue, the lack of fairness in the tax structure is not at the upper end. It's at the lower end. This is a bill that all families in the state who are low-income working families could benefit from, and their children, which is key. So I urge you to make this the exception and move it this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I serve as the legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, the Oregon Law Center, and United Way of the Columbia Willamette. And I'm here today to express our support for House Bill 2046. I need to say that I've been a participant in this effort ever since actually it was first initiated at the federal level. And we often hear about connect, reconnect. I always thought this is one of those places where we ought to connect. Yeah. And so refundability has always been there on behalf of the populations that I pledge to serve. We often hear about a slippery slope, and so I thought maybe this is one of the times when that slippery slope would serve the poor, because we would go from being non-refundable, and I remember when the then Senate President Brady Adams assured me that was going to happen, that it would go from non-refundable to refundable, but we haven't gotten there. Earlier this week, I was one of those who participated in a press conference, House Bill 3490, where we talked about a number of tax expenditures that could provide over $100 million more resources this biennium. I think if you reflect on the groups and the populations I represent, we've been there for a number of other issues. In fact, we were the ones who brought the whole idea of doing a tax expenditure report to the legislature initially. And so we'll be working on finding some resources. But having spent some time at this session in this very room at 1 o'clock, I haven't looked at very many tax expenditure bills within that committee that seem to have a prospect of passage in terms of making some additional resources available. Those of us who have been here for this full meeting today of your committee heard some remarkable testimony about education, in which it was so clear that we really do need to do something about changing the tax structure in the state of Oregon. I am quite convinced that any kind of tax reform package that is developed by Oregonians will include a refundable earned income tax credit. In the last session, you heard from now Senator Westland, Representative Max Williams, and Representative Shetterly with one proposal for changing our tax structure. And when they went to the tax incidence model, it was very clear they had to include a refundable earned income tax credit to make it work. And so I don't think in any way by delaying the implementation of 2046 to the next biennium, you will be interfering at all in bringing some fairness and some adequacy to Oregon's tax needs, and certainly their service needs, and being able to respond to those in Oregon who are working and are struggling. So again, 2046 is not what we had hoped. We wanted it this biennium. But if indeed those resources are not freed up, then we sincerely encourage you to proceed, because we think this is worthy of an exception, because again, it will not be an outlier to any future tax reform. It must be part of it. And I thank you very much for hearing this bill. I encourage you to work with the House Revenue Committee on making some resources available. If that doesn't happen, let's proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we have two folks out here driven, clear from Lincoln County, and these
next.
Are real, okay, they're next. Wonderful. I was just worried we were going to leave here.
I saw them on the list, and I'm glad you mentioned, because they were down the list a little bit, but they will come,
okay,
come
thank
next.
You so much.
Thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair, maybe you'll have time at least for me to introduce myself.
Please talk.
I'm Ron Cease. I am currently the chair of the Advocacy Committee of the Oregon Food Bank, a member of the board, but I'm a former member of this body, both the House and the Senate, and I've served on this committee. Some of us came down here for two purposes, one to give testimony on this bill and also to attend a press conference dealing with payday loans. So we're in one case, we've got a bill that's passed the House. We want the Senate to pass it. In the other case, we've got a bill passed the Senate. We'd like to have the House pass it. But what is so troubling, I think, about this kind of an issue here in this state, we have a high unemployment rate. We're not quite number one in terms of people that are hungry, as the state was for several years. But whenever we are in economic difficulties of any kind, the people who are already at the bottom of the heap get pounded more. This bill, I was here originally in the House when we had the old HARP program, similar, and I'm sorry that that went by the way, and I don't remember all the details about it, but when we eliminated that program, we were suffering some financial difficulties, but nowhere near what I think is the case today. but I would certainly encourage you to give serious consideration, and I hope, despite the financial difficulty, something could be done for these people this session and not wait until next. But we're dealing with people that I think desperately need help. We're living in a state, unfortunately, where all kinds of things are helping us to create more poor people. You just look around and you see it not only at the state level but at the federal level. And this bill and this approach, I think, makes eminent sense.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Cease. I just read an article in the newspaper, must have been the last 3 days, about the widening gulf and incomes in America. I think it was a report that happened in the last few days, but it really showed very clearly. I think it was in the Sunday New York Times, now that I think of it. And it showed very clearly, it was a front page article, the gap and the growing gap that in this country that we have. And so you're right, this is one small arrow to actually confront that gap, and an important one.
And I might say I'm glad I'm not here with you now and having the conversation.
We appreciate that. Yes, Sam. Thank you for traveling from Lincoln City. And if we could have joined, is it the Crofts? If we could have joined the Crofts, Cynthia Hanna. The first sunny, nice day, and we pulled you in here into Salem. We apologize.
Oh, it's okay. Do you want to go first? Ladies first.
Hello, my name is Cynthia Hanna. I am a community advocate. I'm a student. I'm on the board of my local community action agency, and I'm also working in an internship with Multnomah County Commission on Children, Families, and Community. I was able to do outreach for the federal earned income tax credit program this spring, and in doing the outreach, I went to various agencies and organizations, and I spoke with people, and I can tell you that they do turn the refunds around and put them right back into the economy. They use them for things like food, for clothing, for essential furniture. I talked with people who use those refunds to pay for their transportation costs, to pay insurance, to pay for maintenance on their cars so that they could maintain transportation in order to stay employed. I also talked to people who were using the money to pay for medication that wasn't covered by their health insurance, and I've also done that myself because I happen to be a low-income, single, disabled parent, and I've relied very heavily every year on my income tax refund and on the EITC. I've used it for furniture, for medication for my disability, because OHP does not cover effective medication for me. It's helped me relieve a lot of the burdens of being a single parent and living on a low income. It's definitely helped me relieve the burden of being a student. So I'm really happy that this bill is being considered, and it sounds like everyone is very favorable to it. And it is really and truly an investment in low-income working people, as well as an investment in the health of our state. So I thank you for considering it and for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
My name is Robert Croft. I'm here with my wife today, and I'll try to make it short. We only have a minute.
Take all the time you need.
Okay. And then I will. answer. You opened up a can of worms there.
Well.
I won't digress, I promise. To answer, if I could start off, there were some questions raised about the dollars retained in the Oregon economy. we have filled out, and this is a blank, statement of financial condition for individuals. Okay, this is provided from the Revenue Department of Oregon. So it basically breaks down what our budget is per month. Obviously, we have to pay the rent. Obviously, we have to pay the power bill. But the variables, in a micro sense, the variables would go up if you divide it up into what the food costs are and so forth. But that's already been covered. what I want to say from our perspective and what we spend money on, and yes,
there are people in the community that probably would spend it on drugs, alcohol. We live in a area where there is very many people in our situation, and anybody can go during the winter time, during the weekday when there's very few tourists in Lincoln City where I live. You will see that the lowest income people fill the bars, okay, buy drugs. But I don't think there's a whole lot of public employees who would end up with this money that don't have any different behavior. I think that people who think that the money is going to go to nonsense or addiction just because they're low income, I think is a fallacy. What I would like to see, I know what I want to add and stress, and it kind of ties into what was said earlier on another bill this morning. You can fill the gap, the budget gap, by cutting, and I stress this, cutting all salaries for school administrators. You can probably save a lot of money there, and there's a lot of people who would be in those positions who are from the East Coast, love the Northwest. They would take a cut in pay. They're competent. They would make just as competent school administrators as the ones that are there now. And you do not have to pay this enormous salary to school administrators. So I want to get that out of the way. We need the money, basically. And to keep it short and simple, we need the money. We need to bring our kids back. We got three kids who live over with my parents. I know the movie Cinderella Man's out, and his kids had to go live with his parents, but that, you know, that was back in the 1930s. Our kids are living with my parents. They're not living with us right now because we can't afford them. This would help us bring them back home. We are not a dysfunctional family. We do not have drugs or alcohol in our home. We spend the money wisely. But this bit about where we have to spend almost $1,000 a year on Oregon tax, and we get this federal earned income credit from the federal government, and we have to turn right around and give it to the state of Oregon, is ridiculous, and it needs to stop. And I would like to see in the future maybe the money that has been already paid out. I know we're talking about in the future, we're talking about 2007 and beyond. I would like to see a bill maybe next year or the year after where we can go back to 2001 and have it reimbursed to us. I don't know if that's practical or doable, but you know, we're $3,000 in the hole right now. We owe the state of Oregon a lot of money because we both, to make ends meet during the year, we have to both fill out head of household. We have to take the maximum deductions, and then we have a big bill at the end, and that, you know, that's ridiculous. We need to, you know, get this bill through, and we need to do more in the future.
Can I ask you one question?
Mm-hmm.
So when you fill out your, you know, April 15th comes around or whenever, mm-hmm. you fill out your own tax mm-hmm. form.
No.
You don't.
No.
You have so, and HR.
Right, I got the papers here if you'd like to see them later.
And so they say, well, there's this earned income tax credit. You qualify. They just advise you to take advantage of it. Do you think you would know if you didn't have H&R Block? That you'd be able to find the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit?
My father prepared our taxes before. He's getting a little too old for that kind of work, but he found it for us.
He did?
Yeah, he did. He prepared our taxes before.
He found it for you. Great. Any other questions for the panel? Well, we thank you. We thank you for coming down. It's not easy coming before a bunch of legislators. Well, you did well, so thank you very much. We do have three more, Cassandra, Phil, and Ms. Dotson. We're on the floor now. Do y'all want to testify? Do you have new? Those are our final three. Yeah, please, just if there's anything new that we've missed. And what I'm going to do while she gets settled, committee, we're going to recess till 1, and I'm going to give the proponents of on the prior bill, on the dash 8s, 9, and 10, a couple hours here to see if they have 16 votes. And then we'll look to pass the bill at 1 o'clock, a 5-minute in hearing room D, just a 5-minute session. If they have the votes, we'll include them. If they don't, we won't. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chairman Senator Deckert and committee members. My name is Cassandra Garrison. I'm the public policy manager at the Oregon Food Bank, and the Oregon Food Bank supports Senate Bill 2046. Before I begin, I wanted to talk to you about me personally, because in 2003 I purchased my very first home after living in Section 8 housing for 7 years and being a welfare mother. I used my tax return and my EITC to put that down payment on my very first home in Outer Southeast, and there's nothing like having your own yard and a dog. But in 1998, I was interning with the Bureau of Housing and Community Development while I was in graduate school, and I was able to use my federal EIC to help support myself while I was going to college. So, you know, I really am just very interested in having the state refundable. It created financial security for my daughter and I, and, you know, in my position with the Oregon Food Bank, we have seen that people are not necessarily able to live on their wages, even though they may be working full time. The high cost of housing, the high cost of living, you know, a job no longer guarantees that you're going to live out of poverty or free of hunger. So the idea of making the federal EITC refundable recognizes, you know, the whole state EIC, and the federal EIC recognizes that work isn't necessary enough to lift a family out of poverty, and providing this, you know, it really will cause economic stimulus in the community. Having the state EIC refundable like the federal EIC creates kind of a less stigmatizing situation for families. It was difficult for me to go in and use my EBT card. It was difficult to go into the welfare offices. But, you know, when I received that, the federal EIC, I was able to just go into a store like everyone else. You know, I have a graduate degree now. I'm making a lot better money. And the idea of moving out of all of the public assistance programs was a big thing for me. I want to see this refundable because, just like the federal, it's going to have a reward for working families. I mean, we will see that this, the lowest paid workers in our communities will actually be able to put economic money back into their own very, you know, their very near communities. Like when I would get my EITC and my tax returns, I would go to my local Safeway and I would stock up on canned food, you know, the stuff that you can't buy with food stamps. You know, I would buy bus tickets because I needed to be able to go to school. I would stock up on school supplies for my daughter and I, you know, at the local Payless. I mean, things like shoelaces and toilet paper and toothbrushes, things that you can't buy with food stamps. That's what I would use that money on. You know, I was able to pay down my accumulated debt that I had accumulated because I was basically living on, you know, very little income while I was interning with the city of Portland. So I just really would like to see this committee pass this bill on. You know, the idea of making the state EIC refundable, this is going to really help low-income families, not just here in Portland, not in Salem, but statewide. And so I think that we want to look at it, that this is money that goes right back in our community. I mean, Cynthia and I have seen this personally, the impacts of this. We have to find the money, and this is worthy of just saying, make it so right now. So I want to appreciate you taking the time to hear me today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Phil Donovan, thank you for your indulgence. I work on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities and the Community Action Directors of Oregon, and we're both a part of the Oregon Housing Alliance. And I've submitted written testimony summarizing just a few brief comments. First off, we have a slogan, success has a home. But unfortunately for many Oregonians, stable housing is a dream that's becoming impossible to attain. Consider this one fact. For a quarter of Oregon's renters, they're spending over half of their income on paying rent.
While the Housing Alliance is typically here before you on issues of development of affordable housing, we do see also the need to address the low incomes that many hardworking Oregonians earn. And to attain this goal will take a long-term vision, and it will take implementation. But this legislation presents a great legacy opportunity. If you take this opportunity, if you move this legislation, it's going to impact Oregonians for decades to come. So it's not enough just to look at it in the here and now, but as it's going to work out over the long term. So thank you again for extending your time for us.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Donelda Dodson. I'm the Interim Executive Director for Oregon Child Development Coalition, and we do Head Start for migrant and seasonal workers who happen to be really positive recipients of such a bill as this. The average income for the families we see is around $13,000 a year. They're way under poverty. Some of the studies that have been done have indicated that for a family to survive with their basic needs, they need to be 202% of poverty. So a bill such as this would allow these families to be able to put the money back into the income. We've worked with some of our families on FEOP, getting them registered for FEOP. A refundable tax income such as this would allow them to make those monthly payments so that they could then have covered health insurance. So this is one way in which this would benefit those families. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, very good testimony we had this morning. We thank you. We know you care a lot about this issue for the right reasons, and we will work with you on meeting the needs of this biennium. We are in recess. Do I need a pound? We're in recess till 1 for a 5-minute session on 427.